We've just come through a month or so talking about the Diamond Sutra, this beautiful Mahayana text, and looking at the archetype of the Bodhisattva, one who devotes their entire being and all of their actions toward the liberation of all other beings, all beings altogether. Does so by both orienting toward empathy and compassion as core principles, but also orienting toward attaining the state of full enlightenment as a Buddha as quickly as possible in order to increase or broaden one's power to liberate beings. In other words, it's not so much of a deferred enlightenment for the sake of other people, other beings, but an orientation toward enlightenment as a communal phenomenon, and therefore toward the attaining of perfection in a certain way. Paradoxically, one attains perfection by abandoning ideas of attainment or non-attainment. And one saves beings by abandoning the idea that there is such a thing as separate beings. So in a certain way, the whole practice is both sustained by the beautiful and challenging non-dual wisdom piece, that everything is interconnected, and therefore difference, as it were, is a kind of illusion. And that attaining that, one both uproots the seeds of suffering in one's own heart and attains the power to teach and heal and serve in a radically more effective and vast way. With that as our basis, I want to take some time now to just start talking about and looking at, in some specifics, the endemic and systemic ills that plague our particular time. And I'm specifically thinking about suffering or dukkha, distress, pain, relating with some of the large categories of difference. Really, they're all essentially versions of hatred and fear and greed and delusion, manifesting in relation to the perception of difference. And so, race is one of those differences. Gender and sexuality are different but related in difference. The complexities of property and power, class, are a substantial difference. So we can say racism, sexism, patriarchy, militarism, all of these aspects of what arises in human communities, as far as we can tell, mostly in human communities, where difference between groups of people is highlighted and made the focus of comparison and power differential. So I want to use racism as the test example this evening, and lay some of what we know about race into a set of frameworks that are based in the Buddhist tradition. The most basic of these in Buddhist language is called the three great poisons, or the three great fires, or the three defilements. And these are translated variously as attachment, aversion, and delusion, or in more emotional language, lust, hatred, and confusion, or delusion, or ignorance. Grasping or attachment or lust is the perversion of the natural impulse to draw something that we like closer to us, or to move closer to that something that we like or want or feel pleasure in relation to. And aversion or hatred, pushing away, of which fear is one manifestation, is is its opposite, the pushing away or making distance from, in whatever way, moving myself away from that which is painful to me. And then delusion is in some ways the cognitive error or the cognitive emotional error of profound misperception, when we don't actually know what's happening or can't connect with understanding what's true in a given moment. Delusion has aspects like denial, collapse, unclarity in many ways in it, unconsciousness of patterns. So based in these three defilements, these are basically three ways that beings relate with experience. And let's say with other beings, we relate with beings, you know, in any one of these three ways, and of course mixtures of them at all the time. So there are folks who we like, where there's some attachment. I want to be near this person or these people. There's folks that we dislike. I want to be further away from these people in whatever way. And there's relationships that we get that we're confused by. I don't actually know who I am in relation to this, or I think things are one way, but some other information comes to tell me that they're a different way. I find myself deluded or unclear, even about what I want or don't want in relation to a certain experience and set of relationships. So that's one framework. The second framework that I want to bring in is a set of nested circles that I use to talk about relationships in a systemic way. And this set of nested circles is similar to the sequence that we go through in loving kindness practice, where we start sending loving kindness to ourselves, and then based in that being easy, we open to those who are dear to us, a teacher or a benefactor or family members or close friends. And as that emotion is easy to rest in and to cultivate and amplify, we then move to neutral beings, folks who we don't have a personal affection with, but who then we can, in a sense, transfer the feeling of personal affection outward, jumping across the gap between personal relationship and communal relationship in a way. We can jump to the beings who, in a sense, are representative of all beings, folks we don't know so well, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And if we can do that, as that gains momentum, we might bring in then what's called the difficult person or the enemy, the one for whom it's actually challenging to extend kindness to. And so we only do it once there's a strong momentum of kindness through attending to these different easier groups. And then having practiced loving or caring for, being compassionate for beings that are both similar to us and different from us, or beings that we like, beings that we don't like, beings that we feel safe with, beings that we fear, we then have the basis for extending to the true, in a sense, or culminating category of the heart practices, which is the all beings category, which you can divide in lots of different ways, different kinds of beings. But the gist is to be able to offer a wish of kindness or well-being outward in all directions without prejudice or preference, omitting no one, omitting none, as the sutra says. So then this sequence, it talks about relationships, and it talks about relationships that are defined by similarity and defined by difference. And so to speak about systemic issues, here's a set of five circles or layers that I use. And this is the part that's my own invention. It's similar to many others. This is a sequence that makes sense to me. The individual is represented by the body. So, and this is also sort of five things that I might identify with, that I do identify with. So this is layers also of myself. layers of identity. On the body layer, there is what we might call the purely physiological, that which is the experience of my body. My body is a certain size, weight, physical ability, and there's the, in some ways, direct physical experience of the body, and there's the emotions and feelings that are directly related to bodily experience. My hip hurts, I dislike it, I wish it were different, is a bodily level identification and experience. The second layer out is folks who we are related to in a non-choiceful way, and I call this family. These are the folks who, no matter what, they're your family. You don't have to have contact with them, but you can't erase their familyness, their relatedness in a way from your stream. And so then there's a layer of connection where there's identity within a family. Our family is like this. We're from this place. We speak this language. We have these customs within our family. So then there's content, there's identity that lives at the family level. The food your family ate. The details of who we are. Who are we, this family? Further out from that, the next ring out, I call community. And this is a ring of affinity by choice, whether your own or others. So these are the community ring is like groupings of beings, people, who you feel similar to. These are your affinity groups. This is mostly the layer that we mean when we talk about identity nowadays. So, you know, if I relate to a queer community or a mixed race community, this is the layer of that. It's bigger than my family. And within the layer of community, then, this is the layer where we can see that our culture is divided into many groups that overlap in lots of ways. Some are very different from each other, some very similar. And it's in the community layer where we get things like identity-level belief systems, like religions, and, you know, social mores, for the most part, live on this level. Right? These are things that many families do that are related. Not every family has its own set of ethical norms, right? Ethical norms are shared by whole communities. And within the community layer, within all of the layers, there can be internal dissonance. Some communities really hate other communities. Or within a family, some people really hate other people within the same family, but there's still a bond. Within the community layer, there's these pods of relatedness. One ring out I call culture, and these are large-scale structures that manage communities. The cultural level I think of as more or less not chosen. You don't choose what country you're born into. You don't, for the most part, get to choose the laws that are the law of the land in the place where you live. These are large-scale norms and frameworks that organize communities, and communities organize families, and families organize bodies or individuals. And in a certain way, there are a few things. There are some things that, for instance, were part of the personality of a community, but that community got into power and created some norms on the cultural level. And so then those communities' norms became the norms of the whole culture. And you could think of something like money right now as one of those. Not all communities use it in the same way, but a certain community or set of communities started to use it in a certain way and was in power, and therefore they made it the cultural norm. And it takes a significant effort to break cultural-level norms. It's not so hard to break community-level norms. You can slip out of a community and into another where there's different norms. But it's very difficult to alter kind of structural norms within the culture. Worth doing, but difficult. Many communities have to come together to alter cultural level structural norms. And then the last ring outside of that is ecosystem, where again, there's a ground or larger structure that contains and sustains whatever happens within it culturally. And again, every layer can interact up and down along the spectrum. With this as a model, and it's just a draft model in a way, you could divide them many other different ways. But this is some places where we can inquire then into in what way is a body of content, so ideas, concepts, what in Patanjali's language you would call citta vritti, patterns of consciousness, habituated structures. In what way are habituated structures in consciousness, and therefore particularly structures that are limiting or deluded or based in the defilements, preventing liberation, really? In what way are these structures arrayed outward through these levels? And the thing that's important about this is that in many of the early systems, the emphasis is almost entirely on the individual level and a little bit on the family level. Somewhat. There's a very strong, I'll say, like, many of the practices that have come down, like, through the Buddhist and yogic systems seem to be practices that relate to the individual level and the family level. Like, one leaves the family system and becomes a homeless monastic. One then practices meditation to clarify one's own demons, purify the mind, etc. And one does this within the structure of the community, the Sangha. So it's a community-level structure. The monastic discipline, the Vinaya, is a community-level structure that in a certain way replaces the family as the intimate group of connections. And if you're a monastic, a monk or a nun, you essentially get both a new family and a new sort of communal level structure. You may be still embedded in, like, especially if you're in a strong, say, Buddhist country or area or community, your new monastic community may be embedded in a larger Buddhist community, even in a larger Buddhist culture. But at the very least, you get the archetype of becoming a monastic is replacing the blood family with a chosen communal family of monastics. But there's an imperative now in our culture, and it's erupting everywhere, and you know so much about this, all of you in your own ways, to address not just the personal and even family level wounds. In a sense, those began to be addressed really with the birth in the West of psychology and psychotherapy in the mid-19th century. And the in a sense, an orientation toward family and healing healing the family system that begins to arise in psychology perhaps in the 60s and 70s, you know, with Gestalt work that starts to open toward the communal level. But we're really in an era right now where the big demons are not thought of as individual or family level anymore, but really kind of systems level, sort of community and cultural level demons. And so if we take as an example this thing called race, which I won't really define other than to say that there has arisen over the centuries a perception that some lineages of people, families and communities specifically, are fundamentally in some way different from others based on some set of characteristics. Often nowadays, skin color is it. In previous eras, it wasn't always that. Other aspects of language, nationality, culture played that role. But at the moment, skin color is central for mysterious and challenging reasons, historically. One of the ways that racism is often talked about in unlearning practice, unlearning racism practices, is to break the phenomenon down into different kinds of phenomena or experience that coincide with different levels on this map. So, for instance, racism as a structure is a conceptual structure. It's a structure of of communal norms in a way that no individual or even family owns. We could say it's the karmic fruit of centuries of discourse, meaning argumentation, essentially, and the building of ideas about what difference is in relation to this particular category. And so racism, because it's foundational or structural, especially to the post-colonial world, so this is like the last 400 years or so, we're really talking about systems of world or global organization that arose after the period of the meeting of European nations with others, essentially, but we could say with nations in the global north, especially the European or Asian global north, with cultures of the global south, the many cultures in Asia and Africa particularly, and then really the Western Hemisphere is an echo of that in the sense that it's colonial dynamics all the way through North and South America, more or less, with an extremely important different topic being the relationship of colonists to indigenous folks, and that's a different piece that also has race in it, other things as well. So racism, I'll put in the cultural level of that map. I'm going to use three terms that were taught to me in other aspects of racism work. The next one down, I'll call discrimination, where these are patterns of activity, where racism is a kind of conceptual framework, discrimination is patterns of activity. They're still not, in a certain way, individual necessarily. They are, but they play out in terms of large groups of people. So I'll call this a community level or a communal level phenomenon, where patterns of interaction are embedded in our culture, where large groups of people act in certain ways. And these actions then reflect this larger framework of racism in specific circumstances. Right? So this is a place where legal frameworks really start to happen. One community has some power, another community has less power, and here's where we have dialogues about, you know, police violence or inequity in the legal justice system. And this is where things like the prison industrial complex become recognizable as frameworks. And when they become almost nearly universal culturally, they kind of ascend from the community level into the cultural level. Again, that's through power. Somebody institutes cultural norms. And so it's a community that transcends being one community among many to being a hierarchical. So that's the 1%, you know, making laws that govern the rest. But discrimination, we can think of as operating on this middle level. And I'll say that that's kind of the word for what happens both in communities and as a subset in families. And families are an interesting category here. How something like racial discrimination or the deep systemic concept of racism, how it manifests within a family. You might know, like, oh, my family kind of has this attitude toward race. This is who we are, this is who we love, who we hate, etc. On the individual level is where the next term comes in, where we might use the term racial bias. And I've heard those switched around, like where bias is more the communal level and discrimination is the direct individual action. And we could think about that as well. Bias is this way that I've been taught norms by my family, my community, and the cultural level soup that I live in. And based in those norms, I have a kind of individual response, an individual discrimination that's not the same necessarily as how my broad community relates to another broad community. It's refracted through my individual experience. And I have an individual bias. You know, and biases are subtle. right? I'm slightly drawn to certain kinds of people more than others. And my individual experience is not reducible to the generalization of the cultural or community level experience, even the experience of my family, as many of us well know. Right? This is valuable, I think, because one of the deep delusions in trying to address a systemic ill, like racism, is to, and this is what happens in public arguments about it so much, is that folks conflate the levels, and they say like, oh, to criticize racism means that everyone who's in a position of power in relation to it is individually, or in their families, or even in their communities, liable or responsible for the acts of others in a systemic context. And so it becomes valuable to differentiate what's the individual experience of race and racial bias. What are aspects of race and racial bias and racial discrimination that arise not on the individual level but on the family or community level? And then what are the deep structures that no one is free from who lives within a cultural framework? And I'm mostly leaving out ecosystem. It's a more abstract philosophical conversation to ask, and I think it is mostly only asked when someone in an argument wants to escape the specific responsibilities that lie at the family and community levels and even at the cultural level for an ill like racism by appealing to ecosystem level difference. And this is where I think that folks call upon like, well, there's just a fundamental difference between these people and these people. This is where like phrenology used to live, you know, like, oh, well, people with this shaped head are just basic, they would measure heads, you know, oh, and therefore superiority, inferiority, you know, where we would say now, oh, that was a community level bias that was pretending to be an ecosystem truth, a scientific truth. And, you know, when it was seen through, it just had to be abandoned. There's no justification on the ecosystem level for that, and so then it had to fall back, in a sense, to its more transparent identity, which it was a community-level bias. This set of people is afraid of or hates this other set of people. So then we can think about a deep systemic harm like racism on many of these levels, and start to analyze how it behaves differently on different levels. And that means, from a liberation perspective, there are different practices that adhere to different levels. So like on the individual level, you know, one of the practices that I do around this is simply to be mindful of the arising in my consciousness of race as a concept, with no matter what it comes with. In other words, when do I notice race and when do I not? And so first, I notice that there are some situations where the difference between people within the racial categories arises within my consciousness, and other places where it doesn't. And that becomes an analysis into privilege, into identity. You know, for some folks, oh, race doesn't arise. They'll say, I just don't notice race. And then the critique would be, that's a privileged position based on not being oppressed on account of your race, and therefore getting to treat race as a kind of given or something that you don't have to notice. And so then a first mindfulness practice would be to just notice it as a category, to notice when in your awareness race is being logged. Oh, these people are that, these people are that. Based in that, then, the next level would be the Vedana or feeling tone level. Vedana is the category in mindfulness practice where you're aware not just of the thought or the sensation, but you're aware of its valence or charge. Every sensation comes with a charge of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So then I'm moving through my world. I become mindful of the feeling or concept feeling called race has arisen in my awareness. Right? And that takes some doing. It's usually pretty subconscious for many folks, for others not. Oh, notice that I just logged the race of someone who walked in the store or who's here in the room. And then And it's subtle. And this, all of these practices, particularly for well-meaning progressives, which you may be one of, require some amount of overcoming denial, which is the delusion side of the three great poisons. Delusion manifests as denial. So denial is the response that says, like, oh, I don't see race, you know. Which, if we want to honor that response, would be a way, I could reframe it to say, I'm really trying not to see race. I'm trying to practice in such a way that I see humanity rather than race. But nowadays, that response mostly comes from folks who don't want to see race, it seems. And so then there's a critique of that position. So then overcoming denial means to actually be honest with myself about both the perception of race internally and then the charge that it bears. Oh, I'm uncomfortable with these folks more than with these folks, whatever my personal categories are. And to notice that. And then to notice how, based in Vedana, this basic liking and disliking, or pleasant and unpleasant, leading to the reactivities of liking and disliking, then the great defilements come into full bloom. Some folks I simply fear. Other folks I want to be near or feel safe near, or even kind of feel safe in such a way that's unconscious, like I just stop worrying when I'm with a certain set of people. And I want to notice all this and log all of it. That what we're doing really here is we're using the power of mindfulness practice to investigate greed, hatred, and delusion in relation to a specific topic that is important to investigate because it lives on the cultural level. Because it's the water we swim in some ways, it takes particular work to uproot it because it's bigger than us as individuals. And this is part of what gets really hard in this work, is that I try to change my own views, my own behavior. I believe in, you know, a plurality within a body of communities. You know, that's a fine belief. I do believe in that. At the same time, it will not be the case that believing in that automatically means I then am free from the habitual and unconscious responses that have been trained into me by being a member of a racist culture. So then the inquiry goes deeper. And I might go out levels to take it deeper. I say, okay, well, where did I learn this? You know, what are my family's beliefs and actions around race? And again, here I'm using race as the example. You could use any of the great ills, but it's an important one to speak to in the specific, not just in the abstract. What are my family's relationships to race? Mine is really interesting. I'm mixed race, Puerto Rican on my father's side, and as I like to say, Episcopal on my mother's side, meaning white and upper middle class. But I was adopted at birth by a German person and an Italian person. So that's mysterious. There was a time in our culture when the Italians weren't considered white, then they were. And the German person, my father, comes from a mysterious line. I only found out when I was about 40 that my father's father, my grandfather, was Jewish and converted. I always just thought we were Catholic. But actually, so part of us is Jewish, and they weren't considered white either at a certain time. Still aren't, depending on what aspect of the conversation you relate to. There's actually a very live conversation right now within younger Jewish folks, communities, millennials, around whether Jews are white. Are Ashkenaz Jews, you know, descended from white Europeans who might be quite culturally privileged in the United States, but still the recipients of anti-Semitism? Are they white? And there's strong arguments on both sides, which is appropriate because race is a construct. You know, am I white? I spent essentially 35 years of my life thinking that I was white. And then I met this Puerto Rican guy with a strong accent and a gold chain, and I was like, oh, well, you're clearly not white by some category, but what does that mean for me? Because I, you know, I pass. Unless you actually look. And my wife is fond of saying right now, you know, you do realize that you don't pass. And I'm like, I always, no one ever mentioned it. And she's like, so that's mysterious. Who are we? Who am I in my family line in terms of race? How was I treated, et cetera, et cetera. And then out from there, the community level, really where we see the mores and norms of, based in the system of racism, manifesting as habitual action. So discriminatory actions that become common in groups of people, you know, and ways that it's really on this level where we get, I think, some of the juiciest investigation and most important material in investigation of these systemic ills. The systemic structure, the deep, like, that's like, okay, everybody, well, get out your history books and we're going to really study, you know, how did we get here? That's kind of the cultural level inquiry. But the communal level inquiry is where all the meat is in a certain way, you know. And that's, this is the level where we start talking about like what's happening in our government right now, how it's reflecting a certain expression of racism structurally. You know, how our communities, our cities function. You know, and again, how certain folks are policed, how different communities are governed differently, how resources are distributed unequally. How I just read an article about differences in infant mortality and child health, infant health, and childbirth in black mothers in the United States being substantially worse than in a sense they should be if you correct for various cultural norms. And the conclusion of the article basically was that black and African-American women are subject to layer upon layer of trauma and stress that are compounded by the intersection, and we'll log that word for later, for the intersections of the various oppressions of race, being African-American, class in many cases, but the point of the article was that even wealthy black women experience these differences in kind of health and well-being, child health. And then sexism and patriarchy, of course, within being women. And the punchline of the article was basically like, this is so stressful that it's stress alone that accounts for this substantial difference in statistic. And so on the community level then, recognizing where this is where so much of our work lies. And this is important, particularly, I think, because for contemplatives, because within the contemplative systems, very often there's a sense that, like, you know, your most important work is on yourself as an individual. Deal with your own thoughts, your own speech, your own actions, and do deal with those. Of course, that's important. Sometimes we get a perhaps not helpful anymore, and a lot of folks respond to this as not helpful anymore, instruction to, like, you know, clean your own house before you start criticizing the houses of others. This ends up not being helpful to the extent that cleaning one's own house is impossible without the general system being cleaner. In other words, you can't expunge racial bias and discrimination from your own heart while everything around you is maintaining it. You can perhaps do it temporarily when you're in profoundly deep samadhi. You know, if you entered a deep meditative state based in loving kindness, you can totally access mind states that are radically purified in terms of thoughts and feelings coming. But in ordinary existence, when you're in relationship and using speech, you have to contend with, like, ways that the very language that you use is racist structurally. you know, even the word human only came into being when white Europeans had to come up with a way to describe how they were fundamentally different from the Africans they were encountering in the colonial process. And so inhuman arose. Human wasn't a word being used for everybody until it was necessary to distinguish humans from non-humans within what we now call the human race. And so even the word human bears the mark of racial fear and hatred. And throughout our language, there are those seeds, shadows. And so our work then as contemplatives, as folks dedicated to liberation, even if our primary dedication is to individual healing and individual liberation, if you're like, I'm overwhelmed by everything else, I just want to be free, which is a completely valid urge or intention, I'll contend here that even individual liberation, in a very classical Buddhist sense, will not be possible unless we attend to the way that we carry in our individual beings layers of karma that we don't own, that are cultural, that are familial, community level, cultural level. And so then to analyze something like race as a nested web or lattice of discriminatory structures, conceptual structures really, is a way to see the greed, hatred, and delusion that are part of the very fabric of how we conceive of our own identity now. Because they're cultural level and therefore systemic in relation to the entire world right now, I would say that race is a cultural category that's shared now by everywhere that the colonial force touched. And that pretty much means everywhere, with the exemption perhaps of, like, you know, the uncontacted tribes in the Amazon, where there's been a very strong and shaky attempt lately. There's some 20-some, at least as far as we know, fully uncontacted indigenous tribes in the Amazon basin. And so the Brazilian government has a ministry oriented around protecting them that at various times is pure or corrupt in various measures. And there was a scandal recently where someone got too close with one of them and was killed. And if you want a really poignant thing to care about, you might just think about, like, the global situation right now, and that there's these tiny groups of people who have been functioning in the same way for millennia and millennia, indigenous, small indigenous bands living completely separate from the entire rest of the technological world, deep in the Amazon basin. And, you know, deforestation and mining is just, like, pressing in and pressing in. And there's a few folks making a valiant effort. How long can they do this to protect these folks from any kind of contact? So perhaps that's a place where race doesn't even exist as a construct, even though anyone outside will relate to those folks through a racial construct. So then a map for liberation, and really that really consists in a systematic exploration within ourselves and then within our families, within groups of people in community, around how this force operates. And this is in line with all of the teachings in the Buddhist system that say to be free of something, you have to understand it. You have to understand how it affects your actions. Or if we go on the communal level, how it affects the actions of an entire community. What kind of karma is carried by a community, carried by a culture, not carried by individuals? And part of what's important here is that there are aspects of this that are not your fault. but that you can then attend to analytically, contemplatively, by understanding how the perception of difference and the deep defilements, the demons of greed, hatred, and delusion, manifest at these different levels, different frameworks through which we understand who we are. So there's a map to begin with, to begin our investigation. So your thoughts and feelings, particularly places, anything that arises, but I'm curious in ways that the map might resonate, might feel useful, things that it needs to have in it to be more useful. Any responses? And this might also be like, what's it like for you to look more directly at a systemic force like this in the context of contemplative practice? Some folks totally don't want to do this, like want to keep those realms completely separate, even if they respect both, like keep my social action over here and my spiritual practice over here. And there's some good to that. The spiritual practice can be a resource or a home, and then we go back out into action. And now I kind of want to cheerfully demolish that separation.
I've been thinking very recently a lot about like this concept of community, and there was actually a really great editorial in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about how that word has been kind of co-opted by the tech sector, but how it originally meant like shared ownership, right? It comes out of like common and communal and commons and like those kinds of words. So if that's how you really take it to mean, and that's one of these levels that you're talking about, one of these circles, even if you, I think I also tend to want to like keep the contemplative practice, at least when it comes to meditation, like separate from thinking about systemic issues as well. But if you do think of community as something where there is shared ownership and you are, you know, an individual or a body within that community and you own part of it, then I think there is space there for you to kind of think about how your actions or the way you move through the community, how you use the community, how you give back and receive from it. There's kind of a give and take there too, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that this separate bigger thing that you can't like access or
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does to me, at least I think it does. Part of what I hear is that the layer of community is a place where individuals can connect and act in a way that has a lot of impact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, differently from, let's say, trying to find an action in myself that could change like the cultural level, like the deep framework of racism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, it's in everything. So like, what do I even do?
Mm-hmm.
But if I back up a level and go to the community level, I can actually connect with folks who have a practice in relation to it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we might want to identify, what we would want to identify, is that if you took something like meditation as an archetype, if the archetype was something like, get really still so that you can see more clearly and then, you know, do some weeding, basically, uproot the unwholesome, plant the wholesome, then, you know, what would it mean if stillness is let's say, one of the central characteristics of meditation?
Mm-hmm.
How does stillness that allows one to gather clarity and energy, how does that manifest on each of the levels? What does family stillness mean? What does a family do to kind of gather itself, know what's true, and then act? You know, and I think about things like the rhythms of family, like if your family did this, going to church. You know, there's a moment where we stop on the community level, what's us stopping communally? And it might be sitting together, like actually meditating together. But I think even then, largely, we think of it as a bunch of individuals getting together to do an individual level thing with support. But how does an entire community, for instance, stop and find clarity? And I think about things like big protests or, you know, like the teacher's strikes that are going on right now. Like, oh, everybody don't go to work. Like, do a big stopping to gather energy and clarity and concentration in order to act differently, to move the system differently. You know, cultures don't meditate much. Like, cultures are like huge ocean liners that move slowly, and they neither speed up nor slow down in many cases, except in moments of big cataclysm. You know, cultures stop in a certain way. Not even when there's big natural disasters does the cultural level stop. Community levels stop, you know, when like there's a big terrorist attack or a huge flood or something. Everything pauses. But like when in the last 300 years has capitalism paused structurally? Like maybe once or twice in enormous moments. So I'm curious, in the way that you're saying, community shines out of the model as, especially in a time of fractured family belonging. Like, my family doesn't do anything as a family. I don't know hardly anybody who does anything as a family, but that didn't used to be the case. Lots of family activity used to happen. But nowadays, it's a lot of individuals leapfrogging the family level, often with aversion and delusion in relation to it, and finding belonging and activity on the communal level, and chosen family, chosen community. So then that's a place where really belonging and activity and all that can happen. So here, I hear some of that here. Bringing forward. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, I think you said, the karma that we own and the karma that we don't own at one point, and how to make that distinction?
Yeah, totally. In a way, I think that's at the heart of the whole thing. And this is a distinction that the Buddha makes. From a traditional or fairly conservative Buddhist perspective, the karma that I own is the direct fruit of my own volitional actions. So like things that I've done intentionally, you know, volitionally. In other words, not even accidents are the same thing. So like if I accidentally hurt somebody, it's not the same karma as if I intended to hurt them. And the karma that I own, we chant this every time we chant, you know, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions. The idea is that my experience moment to moment, and traditionally speaking, the realm or state I get reborn into, the kind of body, basically, the kind of being, is a result of my volitional actions. And everything else is not mine. So for instance, you know, I was born into a certain kind of family, and I made certain choices in this life. But the fact that I was born, you know, in 1971, at the sort of, right in the middle of the difficult end of the civil rights period, let's say, if we stick with race, and I'm a mixed race adoptee, who was partly adopted because a mixed-race marriage wasn't going to work at that time. But my own karma in relation to that is only about my own volition. So in a certain way, I don't carry... I think actually no one as individuals holds as their individual responsibility the karma of something like racism. Because like I just arrived into a racist world, and I was taught race, you know, from the beginning. And there's these quotes that are like, children don't know what it is until you tell them, you know, until you're like, and that you know, that heartbreaking Nina Simone song that's about like little children making friends and then going home and their families are like, no, you can't play with that person because of race. So the sense that like individual karma is the fruit of volitions, and therefore you can purify your actions by being really ethical and purify your individual karma. But you can't purify through individual actions a karma that exists in a larger circle. even like one circle out. So like I can't purify or cleanse or somehow heal my family lineage just through my own actions. Like it's bigger than me. No matter how ethical or clear I get, my family has momentum in it. The other individuals are individuals, but also we have family momentum. It just is what it is. Light, and then even more so, further and further out. So it seems useful to reflect on, because I want my actions, my practice to be effective. So then I want to apply the right intervention at the right level. Yeah? So like meditating on my individual, trying to purify my individual actions purifies me as an individual, but doesn't purify a higher level. You know, and that's why we, like, in environmentalism, we'll talk about, like, it's not actually about me as an individual stopping driving or stopping using plastic bags. Or racially, it's not about me as an individual, you know, really trying to change my relationship to folks of other races. That's important. But it's actually, there's something else that has to happen on the communal levels, really, for bigger things to shift. And because I don't own those, guilt is not a systemically accurate response. It's not an appropriate response. It's an understandable response because the situation is dire, but it's not a systemically appropriate response as an individual. There is a way that it's an appropriate response on the community level, and that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That I would say, like, okay, let's take white guilt just to end with white guilt. White guilt is, I would say, is not, what is it? It's misattuned to the situation as an individual feeling. If I, as an individual, who with some relationship to whiteness in my identity, feel guilty as an individual in relation to systemic racism, I'm taking upon myself a karma that's not mine. It's not actually mine to be guilty about. I can be guilty about my individual actions, that's all. That's where it's appropriate. It is appropriate, though, that white guilt as a systemic, as a community-level phenomena arise within a community, that middle circle, within the community of folks who identify as white, for that entire community to become aware of its whiteness and aware of the karmic effects of its whiteness, namely the actions that have happened on a communal level in the past that have been so harmful. White guilt would be a wholesome and appropriate force to arise within that cohort if it could be held within the cohort with wisdom, right? As a way of, all of this depends on the theory of not-self, right? That, like, you're not actually an individual. You are this whole web. So if I think of myself in the identity, let's say, of what within the identity of whiteness, then the cohort of white folk that I can identify with, even though I'm mixed race, but I have a foot in it, a lot of feet in it, that cohort has things to be ashamed of. And so, in a certain way, I sort of want to piss off both the progressives and the conservatives with this one. I actually want to reclaim the appropriateness of white guilt within its appropriate placement, which means no individual is responsible to feel it, but a group of people should feel it if we reframe it in the wholesome, if we reframe it in relation to the coming out of denial and accepting culpability for oppression. Again, not as individuals or even as families, but as a communal system. And then families and individuals are culpable for actions that happened at those levels, you know. So then we actually want to use differentiation to learn where the work is in these different areas. And I have the sense, even as I'm saying it, and it's time to stop, but that point and several points related to exactly the thing that you're asking about, when I attempt to write about this, I will need to write about very carefully, because it's difficult. I'm actually asserting that it's possible to do something different in relation to the conversation. And I think it is, but it takes, it'll take spelling it out skillfully. And there are many out there that spell out this kind of thing skillfully. But the distinctions are subtle. I actually don't think they're subtle, but I think they're emotionally charged, so they're difficult. We should end, but if there's any sort of cliffhanger response, and then we'll continue next week, and we'll just keep going with this model and see if we can tease out some of the subtleties in it as we go forward. Yeah.
This is maybe just really quick, but the way I tend to like to think about that kind of thing, the distinction is that guilt and responsibility aren't the same thing, mm-hmm. and that you don't have to feel like the individual ownership, the guilt for making something happen, but if you are participating in a system or a community and you are benefiting from it, then you are responsible in some way mm-hmm. for mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
How it grows and Absolutely. Develops. Yeah.
It might well be that the word guilt is so poisoned mm-hmm. by modern legality that it's impossible to be reclaimed the way that I want to. Mm-hmm. My background for this is that there's a pair of qualities in early Buddhism called hiri and otapa, which translate as moral shame and moral dread. And they are qualities that mean expressing a deep remorse at past wrong action and a deep in fear of future wrong action. And the thing I like about these words, shame, dread, guilt, is that I do think they bear the punch that these issues need, where responsibility mm-hmm. is more accurate, but it's also gentler
yeah.
in a certain way. We all want to think of ourselves as responsible, but not guilty, when in fact we could say, you know, in a sort of historically clear way, white nations have been guilty of these things. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe it's appropriate to frame it in terms of nations. Mm-hmm. White nations did this, right? White people within those nations did specific things. But the nation set, the community level thing, did something, you know, bigger than any individual. Mm-hmm. So that's an important distinction. I think the word responsibility is really valuable there, for sure. All right. So thank you for just being with the attempt to do that. We'll keep looking at it. And if, as you go forward thinking about this, if anything sort of occurs to you that you want to just insert into the conversation, whether you're here or not, like send me a note or something like that. And I'm excited to just flesh this out really into a whole body of work within the Buddhist framework that is starting to grow in many, many ways. And I'm just part of that conversation. So there's a lot of this out there. Thanks for the offerings of your resources to sustain the group. In the box or at the desk. There's a mailing list back there if you happen to be not on it. And take good care. I'll see you soon.